Please call the case.
Case number SCAP-15-520, Hawaii Technology Academy versus Olinto. Arguing for the petitioner, Lydia Wang. Also appearing for the petitioner, Lowell K.Y. Chun Hoon. Arguing for the respondent, Greg M. Ushiroda. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Ms. Wang and Mr. Ushiroda. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes, we are.
All right, and my understanding, Ms. Wang, is that you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we'll give you a warning at that point in your argument. Mr. Ushiroda will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are several reasons why the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission has jurisdiction over student disability discrimination claims against public schools. The main reason, as already stated in our briefs, is because under the plain language of HRS Section 368.1.5, students at public schools are covered. Students can be qualified individuals with a disability, and the DOE and HTA concede that they are state agencies. We've also shown in our briefs that the legislature enacted 368.1.5 as a state counterpart to Section 504 of the Federal Rehabilitation Act, which covers public schools. And the purpose for doing this was to give the people of Hawaii an additional state cause of action against disability discrimination and greater access to justice. And our Hawaii federal court recently confirmed this. Judge Kaye, in his order in Ms. Olinto's federal court case, recognized 368.1.5 as a state analog to Section 504, and he allowed Ms. Olinto to bring claims under both statutes. Today, I'd like to focus on three other reasons why the Commission has jurisdiction. First, the language and legislative history of 368.1.5 show that it applies to state agencies and programs that receive federal funding, as well as those that do not. Second, 368.1.5 is not preempted by Section 504 or the IDEA. And third, the charter schools are not exempt from 368.1.5, and the charter school statutes do not supersede 368.1.5. Moving to the first point, the DOE and HTA assert that 368.1.5 only applies to agencies and programs that do not receive federal funding and are not covered by Section 504. And they point to the language in House Committee Report 819 from the 1989 legislative session, which states that the statute is intended to extend the protections provided by Section 504 to state finance programs. However, if you look up the word extend in Webster's dictionary, the word extend means to enlarge. So that encompasses what's already there. So the legislature intended 368.1.5 to cover both those agencies and programs that receive federal funding as well as those that do not. More importantly, there is no language in 368.1.5 or its legislative history that limits coverage only to state agencies or programs that do not receive federal funds. The language of the statute says, quote, state agencies or any program or activity that receives state financial assistance. The statute does not say state agencies or programs that are only state-funded.
Ms. Wang, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know you're making the point about how this extension doesn't preclude the idea of enlarging the cause of action that's available for discrimination. But in that regard, in terms of enlarging the jurisdiction, how would you respond to the position that has been taken that the statute that pertains directly to the charter school, which is a state statute, is one that's meant to carve out for the charter school the duty to regulate discrimination, and that therefore it is a more specific legislative intent than in 368-1 with respect to the regulation of discrimination in charter schools.
Okay. Basically, what the appellees are arguing is that HRS 302D34 controls over 368-1.5 because it's a more specific statute. But the rule that a specific statute supersedes a general statute only applies if there is an actual irreconcilable conflict between the two statutes. If the statutes simply overlap, effect is to be given to both. And if you look at the title of that particular statute, the title of that statute is enrollment. And the appellees acknowledge that the statute only prohibits discrimination in enrollment and admissions, and it doesn't cover other forms of discrimination. And again, there's no conflict between the statutes because complying with 368.1.5 would not violate Section 304D34.
Aren't the definitions almost identical?
I'm sorry?
The unlawful discrimination, aren't they identical virtually in the state and federal law?
Between which laws? Between, are you talking about Section 504 or?
Okay, I was, excuse me. Go ahead and finish your.
I think you're referring.
I'm jumping to your next argument.
Okay.
But yeah, I think you've covered 302D.
You're talking about 302D34.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so complying with 368.1.5 doesn't violate 302D34, even though they may have different protections, procedures, and remedies. If anything, 368.1.5 and the Commission's implementing rules are broader and more specific than 302D34. So if the charter schools complied with 368.1.5, they would probably comply with their own charter school statutes. And I'd like to point out that the Commission does have overlapping jurisdiction with other state agencies and other state statutes, and there's no conflict. You know, for instance, employees can raise their discrimination claims in the context of a unemployment case, unemployment insurance case, a workers' compensation case, or with our statute, and there's no conflict.
If I could, Ms. Wang, coming back to the issue of the interaction between the Commission's role as it envisions it under 368 and the proceedings that take place under 504, I know that in the 504 proceedings, there's a very detailed administrative hearings process. They're called, I think, due process hearings, where there's a very, typically a very detailed examination of the educational accommodations that have been proposed by DOE, the Department of Education, or I guess the charter school, where the suitability of those accommodations for the child is typically very extensively litigated. And then usually at that point, if the parents who are bringing the action are dissatisfied, they go to federal court. Is that a fair summary of how that process works?
I think it depends on if you're talking about a Section 504 due process hearing or an IDEA special education due process hearing.
Well, I guess I'm talking about both. What is your view of the scope of the Commission's jurisdiction? For example, would a parent who otherwise might go and talk about or challenge the DOE's accommodations for their child in a due process hearing under the IDEA, would they have the ability to alternatively, rather than go through that process, come directly to the Commission under your view?
It depends on the facts of the case. I mean, what we would do is similar to what the OCR does. This is on the federal level. The OCR, it's the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights. They oversee Section 504 claims, and then there's a separate office, the Office of Special Education, that oversees claims under the IDEA. we would do is we would apply a Section 504 analysis, similar to what Judge Kaye did in the federal court case. And what we would do is we would only determine if a student was being excluded or denied the benefits of a program. We wouldn't look at the specific requirements under the IDEA for an individualized education program.
But what? Try to explain to me that distinction. So there are things that you would not do that the feds do. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. And what would the line be? So
okay. So what we would not get involved in evaluating academic curriculum aspects of an IDEA or Section 504 plan. And we would only look to see if the evaluation and plan were provided, if the evaluation and plan procedures were correctly followed, and if the plan itself was followed. Okay. And that's all in the context of whether free, appropriate public education was provided. Okay, we wouldn't look in the into the specific aspects of the development and implementation of a special education plan.
But you would be commenting or the adequacy of the plan or whether it had been followed up on would be fair game in the state proceeding. Again, I'm trying to understand, there's this very, as I understand, a very elaborate proceeding set forth under federal law, and I'm trying to understand the interaction that the commission involves between what it is going to do and between what the feds are going to do, because the defendants raise the issue of possibly conflicting interpretations or guidance to the state, that to DOE or the charter school, that the federal process might indicate certain accommodations are required or necessary, and the other process might come to a different conclusion. How is it that that type of conflict would be avoided?
Well, in terms of accommodations, we would look more at the accommodations that relate to access to a public education. So those involve examples of physical access to a building, you know, whether if a child needs a ramp, if a child in a wheelchair needs a class to be moved from the second floor to the first floor so they can access the classroom, or, you know, if the child needs materials in large print so they can read it.
Was the specific issue that you were addressing, that you were attempting to address here, the issue of whether or not additional time should have been given for testing?
Yes, that's correct. And that's kind of also access to kind of the method of presentation, but not the actual.
Who else would look at that issue? Would the OCR look at that issue?
The OCR could look at that issue, but there's actually no interference with the OCR's enforcement of Section 504, because the OCR itself recognizes the existence of parallel state laws and state enforcement agencies, and they'll actually defer to those agencies.
Isn't the argument then really, it seems to me the conflict argument is really, it sounds like a disguise for a preemption argument. It's almost as if theoretically, there's some conflict. Therefore, we have to preempt the state from getting involved.
You're correct, Your Honor. That's exactly right. And there is no preemption, either under Section 504 or the IDEA.
And the federal courts have said that, right? The federal courts don't say that there's a preemption, right?
Oh, exactly, Your Honor. As we pointed out in our brief, there's a case of JT versus Dumont Public Schools. There's also a few other cases, Hornstein versus Township of Morristown. That's at 263 Fed Sub 2nd at 887. And that's where the parents were allowed to bring claims under Section 504 and the New Jersey law against discrimination. There's also the case Sullivan versus Vallejo City Unified School District. That's at 731 Fed Sub 947. And that's where parents were allowed to bring claims under Section 504 and the California UNRU Act. And here in Hawaii, as I mentioned, Judge Kaye allowed Ms. Alento to bring claims under both Section 504 and 368.1.5. So the case law shows clearly that our statute isn't preempted by Section 504.
What about the, coming back to the question about the legislature's intent, the defendants, I think, argue that the legislature only intended to create a remedy for folks who were not covered by the federal law, as opposed to a supplemental remedy for people who are covered by the federal law. Do you think the statute's ambiguous on that point? And if so, should we go to the legislative history to try to answer that question?
I don't think the statute is ambiguous at all. I think it's very clear. I mean, the statute says, quote, state agencies and any program or activity receiving state financial assistance. You know, it doesn't say only state programs that do not receive federal financial assistance.
You almost have to rewrite the whole clause. I have to put in a whole restrictive clause to get that interpretation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's not there. You know, and practically speaking, almost all state agencies receive some federal funding. So 368.1.5 was just limited to those agencies and that don't receive federal funding, it would basically be useless. I mean, I can't think of an agency that it would apply to.
Is there any potential for conflict, though? Again, realizing that you would say your core, the kind of core issue that you would be handling would be issues like access to the building or access to reasonable accommodations, while the IDEA would be much more focused on the sort of the full educational program. But couldn't something like, you know, the size of the print or extra time kind of fall into either category and thus raise the possibility for some conflict? Or how, and if so, how would that be resolved?
Well, I think in that case, you know, we would look to see how the issue was handled in the DOE due process hearing, and if it involved the same issues, the same parties, and they use the same standard, then, you know, we would probably find no cause and dismiss the case.
I'm just curious, you know, like HCRC and on the employment side, HCRC and then EEOC sometimes. How do you guys, is there anything like that that you work it out between the agencies?
We do have a work share agreement with the EEOC. So, you know, if there are cases where there's like overlapping jurisdiction, the EEOC allows us to investigate the cases.
And do you have some sort of agreement like that along the lines of 504 and 368.1.5?
No.
Is there anything, is that just something like a memorandum of understanding that you guys get, you just talk to each other and do? Or is that at the state and federal level? Just curious.
Well, there's nothing at the federal level.
Okay.
You know, because
so it's just an inter-office thing. It's just a Hawaii office thing? This work in terms of
the work share agreement between ourselves and EEOC is something between our office and the federal government.
Okay, so is there anything that would preclude you from doing that with any other office with respect to 504 and or IDEA issues here?
I don't think so.
What about the availability of regulations or I believe the state makes the argument that is contrary to what the federal government has, which is very detailed implementing regulations, that there aren't specific regulations that would govern your consideration of these claims. Do you think that argument has any merit? Is it accurate? And if so, are regulations a necessary component of you exercising your jurisdiction?
I don't think that's true, because if you look at the state version of those regulations, that's found in chapters 841 and 861, our implementing regulations are just as specific as theirs. I mean, the only difference is in terms of their regulations for IDEA, IEP kids, they're very specific. And that's why we wouldn't get involved in those issues.
So that would be a further source of guidance for understanding where you would intend to exercise your jurisdiction? It's the subjects that are covered in those regulations?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Ms. Wang, doesn't the statute 368.17A3 actually give you some real specificity in terms of remedies that you can apply, such as admissions of persons to an educational institution? That's pretty specific, isn't it?
Yes, yes, Your Honor, that is. And then also in our statute and our rules, you know, we can award other types of relief. Okay, Your Honors, appellees also argue that the charter schools are exempt from 368.1.5 under HRS 302D-25. However, under that statute, charter schools are exempt only from those state laws that conflict with Chapter 302D. Charter schools are not exempt from laws that do not conflict with Chapter 302D. And they're not exempt from the conflicting laws listed as exceptions. And 368.1.5, excuse me, is not listed as an exception because it doesn't conflict with 302D. So that argument has no merit. And the appellees also try to use the doctrine of primary jurisdiction to argue that the Charter Schools Commission has sole authority over charter school student disability claims. I'd like to point out that the primary jurisdiction doctrine only applies when there's concurrent jurisdiction between courts and agencies, and it doesn't apply when there's overlapping jurisdiction among agencies pursuant to separate laws. So that argument also does not have merit. I'd also like to point out that another reason why 368.1.5 is not preempted by the IDEA is because the IDEA itself in 20 U.S.C. section 1415L states that it doesn't preempt other federal civil rights laws such as section 504 and the ADA.
Can you explain again to me why primary jurisdiction theory doesn't apply in overlapping jurisdiction cases? Because in overlapping, there is concurrent jurisdiction in those few instances where they do overlap.
Okay, Your Honor, my understanding is primary jurisdiction is a doctrine of comity between courts and agencies.
Right.
Okay, and it is a doctrine that determines when courts take a issue that divests an agency from jurisdiction. Okay, and in this case, you have overlapping jurisdiction among agencies, and we're not a court. So if we accepted a complaint, and the DOE accepted a complaint, we're not divesting them of jurisdiction. We just have concurrent jurisdiction. So that's why the doctrine wouldn't apply to us as an agency.
So you're saying it doesn't apply to agencies, it only applies to courts?
That's correct. It only applies in situations where there's concurrent jurisdiction between courts and agencies.
So could the claim here have been brought in a DOE due process hearing?
No, because in this particular case,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ms. Alento wasn't raising a claim that related to her son's IEP, or she wasn't asking for special education. Basically, all she was asking for was an accommodation for more time for her son to take a test as a general education student. So it had nothing to do with any of the benefits offered under the IDEA.
Which was denied?
Yes, it was denied.
On the grounds that it was a reasonable accommodation was not necessary?
I'm not sure.
On the grounds that the child wasn't disabled? What was the basis? Just curious.
I'm not exactly sure, Your Honor. All I know is that the accommodation was denied. Okay, and that's exactly the reason why we could accept the case, and there would be no conflict or overlap with a DOE due process hearing.
Because it was actually as a general education student, in other words, not requesting special, not addressing possible rights under the IDEA, but as just any other student coming in, taking the exam, asking for this accommodation, is that correct?
That's correct. So it's another form of an access issue. It's access to be able to take the test. She wasn't asking for the test itself to be changed. Going back to my previous points.
So in other words, the fact whether or not the child it was or is a special education student is basically irrelevant to the facts of this case. The issue, only issue is whether or not the child has a disability for which he was entitled to a reasonable accommodation.
That's correct. You know, and that's one of the issues that, you know, is covered under Section 504 and 368.1.5 that would not be covered under the IDEA.
Because there are actually parents that choose not to have their, do not want their children in special education, but may seek remedies under 504 and or 368.1.5.
Yes, as Judge Kay pointed out in his order and also in the Kimball case, parents do have a right to revoke consent to participating in special education services. And that's what had happened in this case.
Okay. Would you like to reserve your time? And we'll
yes, I would.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Ushiroda, your argument. Oh, you need to speak into the mic, please.
Yes. Is that better?
It's better. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to address the distinctions between 504 and 368.1.5. I believe when Congress enacted 504, they did so without the implementing regulations. So they had to come back and get it implemented. But if you look at 504, there is the subsection A from which 1.5 is patterned. And then there is a whole discussion. There's part of subsection A mandate to the department heads to promulgate implementing regulations to each of their departments. There's also definitions of what constitutes a program and activity that is covered under 504, and that specifically includes colleges, universities, post-secondary higher learning education, and public schools, as well as vocational schools and trade schools. Now, I know Ms. Wayne pointed out that Judge Kay wrote that 504 is substantially similar to 368.1.5. I would respectfully disagree with that because, again, the state version, 368.1.5, just takes into consideration the parts where I believe it's in subsection A of 504. It leaves out the mandate. It does not define what a program or activity is, which the federal government specifically did in identifying public schools and universities. That's an important distinction because if you go back now to legislative history and how 368 came about, there's no mention of this act extending, or 368.1.5 extending to public schools. Nothing. There's nothing in the...
Well, what do you make of the remedy that's in 368? I mean,
you know, Your Honor, that's puzzling. I'll grant you that. It seems to me, and sometimes there are legislation isn't always clearly drafted, but it just stands out there as an anomaly, and that's all I can say is because if you look at the history and all the amendments, which we've addressed in our briefs, there's no intention that or that's indicated that it would extend to the public school system.
But what about the definition of state financial assistance? I mean, that's a pretty broad definition.
State, yes.
And the definition excludes a lot of different entities, but it certainly doesn't exclude educational institutions.
No, it doesn't, but...
I don't mean to be... I mean, is that another anomaly? I don't mean to... But, I mean, it just seems that the statute is expansive, and it cites to 504 in the legislative history.
It does, but in the... it does, Your Honor. It does cite to 504, but if you look at the legislative history and how they came to it, I think they meant to, when it was enacted to apply to discrimination in employment, public housing, and real estate transactions. And then it was subsequently amended and in this chapter. However,
so just to be clear, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're saying that the Civil Rights Commission would have no jurisdiction over the public school system?
As it relates to claims arising out of the IDEA, 504, and any kind of academic education-related matters.
Based on, again, what I'm a little, you're saying that the statute doesn't allow it, and or there's preemption or primary jurisdiction. Are those your arguments?
Yes. The statute doesn't give the commission jurisdiction over claims relating to that arise out of the education as to public schools.
But Ms. Wang argues that there's a clear distinction that the feds are looking at, you know, whether there's an appropriate educational program. That's 504 and the IDEA are all about that. That this is a much simpler and more isolated question, which is a student who is not asking for special, you know, for special education services, but is simply saying, I need an accommodation on a test, and that's outside the scope, I guess, of 504. What's your response to that argument?
Well, I disagree with that argument. In the sense that the student was a qualified individual under 504 and IDEA. He had a severe disability, and he was admitted to HTA, and then he had a subsequent IEP plan. It was determined, however, that his needs could not be met at HTA because it's an online school, and his needs would be best served, which the hearings officer agreed with, at a DOE school. Mother didn't want this. She wanted services, but she didn't want the IDEA label, so she revoked consent. And she revoked consent for that for IDEA. However, we cite the Weaver case, which shows that just because the plaintiff has revoked IDEA, revoked consent for IDEA, if the claims are such that can be remedied through the IDEA, such as accommodations, such as more time to take tests, because all those things affect the ability to access education.
But I'm trying to follow your argument. I'm sorry to interrupt, but so you would disagree with Judge Kaye's analysis about Section 504 not preempting, as well as Ellenwood out of the First Circuit and the DeMont Public Schools case, and your view is that Section 504 actually does preempt the state's efforts to regulate discrimination in public education?
Insofar as it arises from provision of education and academics, yes.
Has the HCRC conceded that they have no interest in trying to regulate IEPs and or the actual education plans? That this is basically, it sounds like a run-of-the-mill ADA type discrimination claim here.
They try to draw that distinction here. And what it is, they're saying that, yes, we'd only have jurisdiction over non-academic situations, such as providing a student more time to take a test or a mobility issue. Those kinds of students will always have a 504 plan. I mean, it's a disability they have. What the distinction that needs to be made, and they're trying to make a bright line distinction between non-academic and academic, and that just can't be done, because what this relates to is how the child receives the education? Is it the ability to access a
free I'm sorry, but education? The amount of time necessary to take the test, it's something that I don't think it has to always deal with education. It's, I mean, we get those on, you know, taking exams all the time.
But taking the exam is part of the education process.
No, it's sometimes it's part of an employment process.
That could be an employment context, but I'm talking about an education situation here. And what the claim here is, does the issue here is whether the commission has jurisdiction over claims.
You're saying that the statute doesn't give them jurisdiction?
In the education context, yes.
Even though the remedy, one of the remedies, is allowing admission to educational facilities?
Yes, and as I explained to you.
If we do not follow that argument, what is your next argument?
If we
believe that the statute gives jurisdiction, do you have alternative arguments as to why the HCRC does not have jurisdiction or should not exercise its jurisdiction?
So if you're saying if the statute gives the commission jurisdiction, what is my...
Yes, what are your alternate arguments?
Well, I think that just goes, that is contrary to what the federal government has expressly...
Are you arguing preemption? I don't see anything in the statutes that says preemption. Are you arguing conflict preemption, field preemption, or implied preemption? What are you arguing?
Obstacle.
I'm sorry?
Preemption... conflict preemption, I am arguing.
Is
Where's
there
the
any
conflict?
Case that has held that a state law is preempted by 504?
We did not cite any in our briefs.
Well, is the reason because there aren't any?
Well, I have not.
I couldn't find any such cases, and I did find cases under the IDEA saying the IDEA does not preempt state law if state standards meet the minimum federal guidelines. In other words, it's kind of like constitution analysis. The federal rules are the floor, not the ceiling. In other words, states can provide more protections than what the federal government provides. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, again, I would go back to what the OCR has stated, I mean, the Department of Education has stated on federal level that 504 is to be enforced through the Assistant Secretary of Education, and then it is delegated to the Departments of Education at the local level. This is a clear mandate from the federal government. The DOE and the charter school has already set forth a procedure for to hear due process claims.
Does maybe my memory is incorrect, but does DOE in their warning, do they say something about you could be, they cite to state and federal law or something. Isn't there something like that? Even in the paperwork that they give, they actually reference both state and federal?
I'm not sure which paperwork you're referring to, Your Honor.
I thought that there was something given to people to inform them that they may have.
The procedural safeguards.
Exactly.
Yes, that is just for example, when a parent attends an IEP meeting or a 504 meeting, they are given before the meeting starts procedural safeguards to let the parent know what their rights are under.
And it cites to both
IDEA and 504. Correct.
Okay. Do you also, are you still arguing primary jurisdiction also?
Yes.
Okay. How do you respond to Ms. Wang's argument that it only applies to where there are concurrent jurisdiction between courts and agencies?
Yes, and that's if there is a finding that there is concurrent, yes.
Assuming there's concurrent jurisdiction.
Assuming there is, that's what we cite in our brief. Assuming there is concurrent jurisdiction.
Is it our role to determine, candidly, I couldn't find any cases in the United States saying that primary jurisdiction applies between where there are two agencies with concurrent jurisdiction. Are you aware of any such cases?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Can I direct you back to Judge Kaye's decision, and which has been cited as addressing the issue here of whether there is conflicts in jurisdiction? Do you believe that decision was wrongly decided, or it's somewhere how reconcilable with your position in this case?
I'm sorry, where are you?
Judge Kaye's decision, I believe, was cited by Ms. Wang, correct? Judge Kaye's decision in, I believe it was 2014 Westlaw 6609-23213. Not ringing a bell for you?
I'm sorry, what the question was?
My question is, did Judge Kaye get it wrong, or is his decision reconcilable with the position you're taking here? As to whether there's an overlap or possible conflict between the two statutory regimes. I think the petitioners are arguing that it reflects or indicates a finding that there is a determination or by the legislature that there should be two overlapping regimes and that there can be recoveries or remedies under both regimes. My understanding of your argument is that the state regime only applies if there's no federal funding. So that would seem contrary to your argument. I guess I'm asking, what's your response to their argument about Judge Kaye's decision? You think it's wrong, or you think it's they're misreading it somehow?
Well, I think, and I'm really looking at it, Your Honor, as to Judge Kaye's holding as it applies to 368, and probably says it's an analog to 504. And I say that at the beginning that I disagree that the statutes are substantively similar, because they're not. There's a lot that the legislature, in enacting 568, left out, such as the promulgated regulations, the definitions of what constitutes.
How does that matter? Why does that matter to your analysis?
Because it shows an intent, Your Honor, that the legislature did not intend 368 to apply to in the public education setting. There is already a well-established procedures for the resolution of 504 claims and IDA claims that comes from the Department of Education.
But aren't we bound by the plain language of the statutes? The statute?
Yes, and if we look at the plain language of the statute, it says it only applies to those programs and activities receiving state funding.
Are you suggesting that charter schools don't receive state funding? I think I saw that in your briefs, but is that really your position?
They receive state funding and they receive federal funding as well. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that I believe that in this context, and what the legislature intended to was not to overlap to those entities already receiving, enjoying the protections of 504 because they receive federal funding, but they're merely extending this to those agencies again, where they perhaps they don't receive federal funding. It's just state funding.
But is that explicit in the? That's why I asked her if the plain language of the statute's ambiguous. What's the ambiguity that you see in the statute that would allow us to look at the legislative history?
Reference to an educational institution. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, I guess if we tried to interpret the statute to make sense, then we'd suggest that when the Civil Rights Commission's jurisdiction was put together, it was meant to apply to state agencies that and also programs that receive state funds that are meant to involve state education, right? Because it's not specifically exempted, and there's a remedial section of the chapter that requires that the Civil Rights Commission consider reinstating individuals in the educational institution. But let me ask you, if I might, Mr. Shiroda, you did prevail at the circuit court level,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
What was the analysis of the circuit court? What's your understanding of what the circuit court's reasoning was?
Well, the circuit court looked at the legislative history and determined that the 5368.1.5 just did not confer jurisdiction to the commission over education-related claims.
Based on the legislative history?
Based on the legislative history and the wording of the statute, there was an absence of...
Where is that reasoning reflected?
I think it's in the transcript, because the order just says it granted. But it's in the... if you read the transcript...
Okay.
There is a... you can see the... I believe it was Judge Nishimura.
I think the transcript reflects very thoughtful questions,
yes.
But I don't think there's actually, I don't think the judge actually gave any specific analysis. I think the judge's questions certainly indicated familiarity.
That is correct, Your Honor, and I guess the responses that came to those questions, and again, we did, my colleague who argued that matter.
Have you seen the transcript?
Yes, I have.
So what about the transcript makes you think that that's the point that the judge relied upon? I was just curious, the legislative history. Because of the questions that were being asked, is that it?
Yes, and those questions were being asked. I think she relied on that, and I haven't read the transcript in a while, but that is what I recall. I mean, I remember that Judge Nishimura
Were there findings of fact? I'm sorry to interrupt, but were there findings of fact and conclusions of law prepared by the state?
There were not. It was just an order that was issued.
And why was that, that there weren't any findings of fact or conclusions of law prepared?
I do not know.
You know, I think I can understand that the DOE and or the charter school here may be concerned in terms of, like, fighting different fronts on some of these issues, but in terms of the plain language of the statute, it does seem to apply to an agency that you've conceded it's a state agency already, so we don't even have to go to the state financial assistance prong already. It seems like the remedy, if the DOE has a remedy, might be to go to the legislature, and or I wanted to ask, what would prevent you from entering into some sort of work sharing agreement as the HCRC and or EEOC do for employment situations? In other words, I can understand the concern that, you know, the federal government may come up with one ruling and it could conflict. I can understand that concern. But what would prevent you from seeking that type of resolution in this context?
Well, I don't know, you know, I really don't know how to answer that question because that just hasn't come up, but I...
Is this the first case that you're aware of that the HCRC has taken a case on,
yes,
on an educational institution?
This is a statute that has been on the books.
So it hasn't acted on, and this is a charter school, but you're saying regular DOE public schools also?
Correct.
This is the first time that you're aware of?
Yes.
The state is aware of?
Yes. This is the first time that they've brought this, that I'm aware of. And I also would like to point out at the administrative level, the commission's own director opposed extending jurisdiction over this claim based on, again,
the Charter School Commission wants to exercise jurisdiction.
Right. And
itself. And so are they taking the position that the OCR doesn't have jurisdiction? No, right? I mean, the federal government does get involved in 504 and or IDEA issues with charter schools, right?
Yes, because
okay.
Their mandate does extend to public charter schools. But what I wanted to get back to, your point that you raised, that this is the first time that I'm aware of that the commission is actually seeking to extend jurisdictions to this type of disability discrimination.
Is it extend or exercise?
Or exercise. Thank you. Again, this statute has been on the books since 1988. now they're starting to look at this. And again, at the administrative level, when this first was, the commission's own director submitted a very detailed brief explaining why he felt that the commission did not have jurisdiction to hear such claims. And again, looking at his understanding of the statute, just never, there's no specifics that there was to give him any indication that the legislature intended this statute to apply to public schools, charter schools as well. And I think that's telling, that where your own director is telling, saying that we don't have jurisdiction, that's why we haven't accepted these kind of claims. I think that says a lot. And again,
I'm sorry, which director was that again? I'm sorry.
I believe that was William Hoshijo. Okay. Yes. So. Again, you know, and it is worth noting too, going back to this statute, Your Honor, that, I mean, if you look at the changes that were done, you know, the 368 specifically, all those mentions exercising jurisdiction in employment, public housing, and real estate transactions, and they have the implementing regulations to deal with those situations. Here, for 368, it's a rather circular definition. Excuse me for one moment. Now, 368 says that it includes enforcement procedures to accept, investigate, conciliate, and prosecute discrimination complaints filed in regard to unfair discriminatory practices as defined with 489, 515, and 378. And each of those.
And complaints filed under this chapter.
Yes, and complaints filed under this chapter. Correct. Now, 489, 515, and 378 each have specific definitions of what constitutes an unfair discriminatory practice, as does the federal statute 504 through its implementing regulations in the CFR, which at CFR 34104, I believe, is a broad, very detailed listing of what constitutes this unfair discriminatory practice in the disability context.
There's a definition on the statute, isn't there?
Yeah, there is a definition, yeah. And it's
and there's procedures for filing complaints.
Yes.
And now, there's procedures for investigating, and there's, I mean, the statute's pretty comprehensive.
Yes, as to employment, public housing, and real estate. But if you look at, now, if you look at 368.11, well, 368.3, that is the powers, and that one, it does not include 368 discrimination claims based on 368.1.5.
I'm sorry, it says they can investigate, as Justice Pollack just said, in complaints regarding filed under this chapter. In this chapter, it precludes discrimination based on race, color, religion, age, sex, including gender identity or expression, sexual orientation, marital status, national origin, ancestry, or disability in employment, housing, public accommodations, or access to services receiving state financial assistance.
I'm sorry, what statute are you referring to?
368.1.
Correct. When I'm referring to 368.3, okay, filing this chapter, 1611. For the purposes of, it defines what an unlawful discriminatory practice is.
But again, 36811 specifically says, commission shall have jurisdiction over the subject of discriminatory practices made unlawful, and it lists all the chapters, and then it says, and this chapter.
Correct. And if you go to B, it says, for the purposes of this chapter, unlawful discriminatory practice means an unfair discriminatory practice, or like terms, as may be used in Part 1 of Chapter 489, Chapter 515, or Part 1 of Chapter 378. There's no definition or description of what constitutes an unfair discriminatory practice. I don't know how you can have jurisdiction or something that's not defined. I mean, yes, it's defined in an employment context. Yes, it's defined in a real estate transaction.
Mr. Shiroda, if I'm following you, you're making the argument that the Civil Rights Commission is limited only to discrimination in employment, public housing, and real estate?
It has, it has it also under 368. I'm just saying that 368 doesn't extend to public schools and charter schools.
To the provision of educational services, it would it extend to an employee of a public school or a charter school who's being discriminated against?
I believe OCR handles that, OCR can handle that, but there would be the employment section, right?
That's my question.
Yeah. Yes. Because there is a statute for that.
Anything further for the court at this time? Thank you very much. Ms. Wang, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, 2 points. Mr. Shiroda referred to the 1988 amendments to Section 504, which did specify that programs and activities refers to public educational institutions. Prior to that, Section 504 was actually identical to 368.1.5, or materially identical to 368.1.5. And even before the 1988 amendments, Section 504 was interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court to apply to public educational institutions. In our brief, we refer to the case Southeastern Community College versus Davis, and that involved a deaf student who sought accommodations at a nursing school program. And so the Supreme Court did apply Section 504, even without those 1988 amendments, to public educational institutions. And I believe that is one of the reasons why the executive director of the commission initially did not think that 368.1.5 applied to educational institutions, because it did. 368.1.5 doesn't have that language in subsection D of Section 504. But given this Supreme Court case, this is the reason why the commission found otherwise.
What, again, the claim here related to the denial of extra time for taking of the admissions exam, is that correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. And, you know, I'm looking at your reply brief, and it says, the commission fully comprehends its role is not to make educational judgments. It has no desire to intrude on academic issues and will not create or enforce IEP, IDA, and Section 504 education plans. How is the question of giving somebody time to take an exam, is that not getting into academic issues? And to the extent there's any gray area there, where would we go to find the answer to whether that is or isn't an academic issue and within the commission's view?
Academic modifications deal with what a child learns, whereas non-academic accommodations deal with how a child learns. Okay, so again, in this particular case, the parent was asking for more time. She wasn't asking for a different test.
Wait a minute. Based on what you just said then, are you saying that the commission would get involved in terms of how a child learns? I mean, some of these IEPs have things like the child gets to sit close to the teacher or, gosh, you know, all kinds of things. It's how they learn. Are you saying that the commission is going to get involved in issues like that?
Well, it relates to access. You know, like if a child can't hear very well, you know, and is seated at the back of the room and asks for the accommodation of being able to sit closer so they can hear, or if the child has a sight impairment, if the child could see, I mean, it again doesn't go to the curriculum matters.
But that couldn't the IEP address those very issues? In other words, if the student is struggling because of those things, the IEP might say the following accommodations need to be made. The student needs to be in this location, needs to be given extra time, needs a teacher with the following qualifications, needs an aide with the following qualifications. How are you not, or where do we go to determine when you're into academic matters and when you're not under the test that's, or the standard, I guess, or the commitment, perhaps reflected in the reply brief?
Okay, well, in terms of those kinds of accommodations, we would just look to see if the accommodation was provided.
But what if you disagreed with what if the commission disagrees with the accommodation that's provided as a result of the due process hearing? The due process hearing results in an accommodation of, you know, one half-time extra student helper in the classroom and X amount of hours of additional instruction and the provision of a particular type of equipment or material. And if the commission disagreed with that, the commission could come to a contrary conclusion?
Well, I think we would look to see if the accommodation was reasonable in terms of giving the child access to education. If it was reasonable, I mean, we would.
So you're basically saying you do want to review IEPs?
No, we don't.
But these are all things that are within an IEP.
Well, it kind of depends on the particular situation. You know, the situation that Justice Reckonwald suggested, those are aids in terms of providing an IEP. And we would just look to see if they were provided or not.
But you would be reviewing, in essence, you'd be reviewing the plan or the sufficiency of the plan, correct?
Well, we would be looking to see if these accommodations were provided or not. And if they weren't provided, or if the plan wasn't fulfilled, then that would be not providing a FAPE.
Can I ask you about your recognition, if at all, of a conflict with 504 and an individual education plan? Because don't you have to concede that if it's an education plan that discriminates, an education plan that, for example, has as one of its criteria that the individual only be able to study for X period of time and their handicap would suggest they need more time, in that situation you would be examining a plan, right?
I'm sorry, could you
question? Seems to me,
Justice Wilson, maybe speak into the mic too.
Thanks. It seems to me that what you're just being asked to consider whether the Civil Rights Commission would investigate if an individual plan that could be analyzed under 504, whether an individual plan discriminates, in particular, for example, if it discriminated in terms of access. Like, for example, the student's plan said that they'd only have certain period of time in which they could study when actually they needed more. that wouldn't, just because it's part of the plan that could be reviewed under Section 504, wouldn't necessarily preclude your jurisdiction, right?
That's correct.
So the parent would have the choice of going to the Civil Rights Commission versus federal district court? My understanding right now is if the parent is dissatisfied with the plan or the determination by the hearings officer of what an appropriate plan is, they go to federal court, correct?
Well, first they would have to go through a due process hearing.
That's what I mean, after the due process
hearing. Afterwards, they could go to state or federal court.
All right, and now they would have the option of going directly to the commission instead, or would they?
They could.
Okay.
It's another option, which we believe the legislature decided to provide when it enacted 368.1.5.
And then you would be able to look at, for example, and determine whether, you know, the provision of a half-time teacher's aid for and a particular type of equipment or instruction was or wasn't appropriate for that child. And if you determine that, if the commission determined that it was not, then the commission would be able to order something different and perhaps even award damages. Is that correct?
No, because, you know, we would just look to see if the provision of that service was reasonable or not. It doesn't have to be the best accommodation for the child. It's just if it's reasonable, it enables the child to learn.
But that's what the federal court would be doing, correct, typically? You would. I'm just trying to understand how this enforcement regime would work, which is now there's another option. Instead of going through the due process hearing and then bringing a claim in federal court, the parent can go directly to the commission and litigate all the same issues that they could litigate in federal court, but could do it in front of the commission.
Well, they couldn't bypass the DOE due process.
Right, but
hearing.
After the hearing. My understanding is typically after the hearing, the parents still have a right to go to the United States District Court to challenge the outcome of that hearing, correct?
Right, and that's exactly what Ms. Alento did in her case. She challenged, you know, her son's IEP. Plan because they basically wanted to transfer him to a different school, but she also raised Section 504 and 368.1.5 claims.
But so could she have just bypassed going to the federal court and just gone directly to the HCRC in the future?
She could in terms of Section 504 claims, but not IDEA claims. You know, the claims related to you know, the development and implementation of the IEP, or if the claims related to relief that's provided under the IDEA, she still has to go through a due process hearing.
And that's because that somehow there's federal law that requires that?
Yes, that's in the administrative exhaustion provision under the IDEA.
Okay, but that only applies to the IDEA, but anything that's a 504 issue independent of the IDEA could come to the commission, correct?
That's correct.
Did you say that that after the due process hearing, I've seen it, it can actually come to state court also. So instead of going to state court, they could go to the HCRC, but you wouldn't have jurisdiction over the IDEA claim.
Right, that's correct.
And
so
then,
they couldn't bypass, you know, they have to go, you know, in terms of IDEA claims, they have to go through the due process hearing. They can't bypass it by coming to us.
What if they decided to waive all the federal claims and just start going under the 368.1.5? Is that a possibility?
That is a possibility, but we would only be deciding the issues under 368.1.5. We wouldn't be deciding the IDEA issues.
But why couldn't they raise the same issues under the mantle of discrimination under the federal law? That, you know, my child is being discriminated against because the only way that my child can get a fair shot at an education is if he or she has a half-time teacher's aide assigned to them and is given this particular special curriculum. So wouldn't the commission, in essence, be litigating, or wouldn't the same issues be litigated before the commission that would be litigated in the due process hearing?
No, Your Honor, because we can't make those educational judgments. We're not authorized to do it.
Why not? If it's discrimination, if that's the parent's claim, is my child is being discriminated against because the only way my child can get a reasonable education is if he or she has at least a half-time teacher's aide and a particular specialized type of curriculum. And they say that's discrimination under 368.1.5. I am not, and they say we're not relying on IDEA, we're relying on 368.1.5. What would the commission's position be?
Well, because they're asking for certain services under an IEP, and we can't grant them.
No, they say they're not asking. They're just saying it's discrimination. If my child doesn't have access to a halftime teacher's aide in a particular curriculum, my child is being discriminated against, and I want the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission to adjudicate that claim.
Well, we wouldn't consider that an access issue.
Why not?
Because it's an educational determination.
Where does that, where do I find, where does it tell us that?
Well,
in your statute, does it tell us that?
I think it's in the language of the statute itself.
Which statute?
368.1.5.
There's something in 368.1.5 that tells us what the line is between education and non-education?
Yeah, because it says excluded from participation or denied the benefits.
What, denied the benefits?
Yeah, denied the benefits. So were you, you know, it's exactly what Judge Kaye did in the
denied the benefits of education?
You know, Judge Kaye ruled against Ms. Alento in her Section 504 claims because he said you weren't denied the benefits of an education. They did give you a Section 504 plan. They did offer you a, you know, special education, but you revoked it, you know. So she didn't prevail under her Section 504, 368.1.5 claims because she was given those benefits, but she didn't want them.
But well, I'm just saying, it's your position that the HCRC could look at the same issues under 368.1.5, totally excluding the federal law, correct?
Totally excluding.
We don't even have to look at the federal law. That it could just be under 368.1.5.
Which federal law, the IDEA or Section 504?
Both. I'm just saying under 368.1.5, could someone come to the commission and say, you know, this is not a free and appropriate public education, or I'm not getting the benefit of a public education?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And so just totally not go, and then, so at that point, wow. So
what's to keep forum shopping then? What's to keep people from just bypassing that, the due process hearings and coming directly to the commission and trying to decide which entity is more likely to give them a better, or they're more likely to achieve a different result?
Well, they do have a choice of forum.
Well, wait a minute. Under the federal law, exhaustion is required, right? Well, exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Yes.
Does our state law require the exhaustion?
Does our state law?
Right. I mean, 368.1.5. Could they just come directly to you and say, I'm filing a complaint because I wanted an IEP that does this and does that for my disabled child and they're not doing it?
I mean, they could file.
And then would you then get involved in helping conciliate the appropriate IEP?
No, we wouldn't. You know, if they didn't get an IEP at all, you know, we would review that and say, yes, you're being denied the benefit of an education. But in terms of the specifics of an IEP, if you disagree with the specifics of an IEP, we wouldn't get involved.
But you would get involved to see whether or not the IEP was complied with.
Yes. So, you know, there are cases where, you know, the students have an IEP. They're supposed to be given all these services or all this type of instruction. It's not done.
No IEP at all, you folks would, the commission would adjudicate it.
Yes.
Content of the IEP, you would not adjudicate it.
Yes.
Whether the IEP had been complied with, you would adjudicate it.
Yes.
So if there's a case like, well, the DOE says, you know, it's a halftime teacher, but actually it's a person who's in another room, but they're there and they're available to come over halftime, but they're physically in another room 60% of the time, that kind of claim, then you folks would be, someone could come to the commission and say, hey, there's a denial of access to this benefit because I have a plan and it's not being complied with. You would be in the, that's the kind of claim you might adjudicate.
Yes.
You would treat that as a discrimination issue,
yes.
Even though there may be like other issues, like God, who knows what other issues there may be, like the aid that was supposed to be there was, you know, got sick and was gone, and then all of a sudden they were short a teacher, which often happens in public schools, or things like that. You would treat it as a discrimination claim at that point.
Yes, we could.
Okay, and just so.
Because the plan wasn't followed.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to speak over you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no. Did you finish your answer? I didn't mean to interrupt you. Are you complete? Did you complete
yes,
your answer?
Yes.
Where would we find the differentiation that you just mentioned, that no IEP commission would consider, adequacy of IEP commission wouldn't consider, compliance with IEP commission would consider? Is that set forth in a rule or reg or decision of the HCRC? Or is it your view that that flows from the language of the statute, which I think was your, I believe is your argument?
It does flow from the language of the statute, and it's what the OCR does, and that's how the OCR makes its distinction between enforcing Section 504 and what the Office of Special Education, which is a separate office from the OCR, what the Office of Special Education does.
So the HCRC is developing expertise in IEPs issues at this point. Is that what we're dealing with?
We're trying to develop expertise in distinguishing those issues.
Okay.
You know, and I'd like to point out that the DOE itself can makes that distinction because it has separate rules dealing with Section 504. There are chapters 841 and 861 deal with 504, and their chapter 860 deals with the IDEA. So if they can make that distinction, we can make it too. And I'd also like to point out that the DOE itself recognizes that there can be concurrent claims under Section 504 and 368.1.5. Because in their Rule 841-2, it lists both Section 504 and 368.1.5 as discrimination laws that the public schools can violate. And in their Rule 841-6, it states that students and parents have the right to seek relief from other federal or state agencies. So 368.1.5, that's us, you know. Another state agency, that's us. So under their own rules, students can file claims with us under 368.1.5.
Anything further at this point, Ms. Wang?
No.
Any wrap-up at all?
No.
All right, very well.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to thank both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.